Blackstone Audiobooks presents The Scarlet Pimpernel by Baroness Orczy. Chapter 1. Paris, September 1792. A surging, seething, murmuring crowd of beings that are human only in name, for to the eye and ear they seem naught but savage creatures, animated by vile passions and by the lust of vengeance and of hate. The hour, some little time before sunset, and the place, the West Barricade, at the very spot where, a decade later, a proud tyrant raised an undying monument to the nation's glory and his own vanity. During the greater part of the day, the guillotine had been kept busy at its ghastly work. All that France had boasted of in the past centuries of ancient names and blue blood had paid toll to her desire for liberty and for fraternity. The carnage had only ceased at this late hour of the day because there were other more interesting sights for the people to witness, a little while before the final closing of the barricades for the night. And so the crowd rushed away from the Place de la Grève and made for the various barricades in order to watch this interesting and amusing sight. It was to be seen every day, for those aristos were such fools. They were traitors to the people, of course, all of them, men, women, and children, who happened to be descendants of the great men who, since the Crusades, had made the glory of France, her old noblesse. Their ancestors had oppressed the people, had crushed them under the scarlet heels of their dainty buckled shoes, and now the people had become the rulers of France and crushed their former masters, not beneath their heels, for they went shoeless mostly in these days, but beneath a more effectual weight, the knife of the guillotine. And daily, hourly, the hideous instrument of torture claimed its many victims, old men, young women, tiny children, even until the day when it would finally demand the head of a king and of a beautiful young queen. But this was as it should be. Were not the people now the rulers of France? Every aristocrat was a traitor, as his ancestors had been before him. For 200 years now the people had sweated and toiled and starved to keep a lustful court in lavish extravagance. Now the descendants of those who had helped to make those courts brilliant had to hide for their lives, to fly if they wished to avoid the tardy vengeance of the people. And they did try to hide, and tried to fly. That was just the fun of the whole thing. Every afternoon, before the gates closed and the market carts went out in procession by the various barricades, some fool of an aristo endeavoured to evade the clutches of the Committee of Public Safety. In various disguises, under various pretexts, they tried to slip through the barriers which were so well guarded by citizen soldiers of the Republic. Men in women's clothes, women in male attire, children disguised in beggar's rags. There were some of all sorts, ci-devant counts, marquises, even dukes who wanted to fly from France, reach England or some other equally accursed country, and there try to rouse foreign feeling against the glorious revolution, or to raise an army in order to liberate the wretched prisoners in the temple who had once called themselves sovereigns of France. But they were nearly always caught at the barricades. Sergeant Bibot, especially at the West Gate, had a wonderful nose for scenting an aristo in the most perfect disguise. Then, of course, the fun began. Bibot would look at his prey as a cat looks upon a mouse, play with him, sometimes for quite a quarter of an hour, pretend to be hoodwinked by the disguise, by the wigs and other bits of theatrical make-up which hid the identity of a ci-devant noble marquise or count. Oh, Bibot had a keen sense of humour, and it was well worth hanging round that West Barricade in order to see him catch an aristo in the very act of trying to flee from the vengeance of the people. Sometimes Bibot would let his prey actually out by the gates, allowing him to think for the space of 2 minutes at least that he really had escaped out of Paris, and might even manage to reach the coast of England in safety. but Bibo would let the unfortunate wretch walk about 10 meters towards the open country. Then he would send 2 men after him and bring him back, stripped of his disguise. Oh, that was extremely funny, for as often as not the fugitive would prove to be a woman, some proud marchioness who looked terribly comical when she found herself in Bibo's clutches after all, and knew that a summary trial would await her the next day, and after that, the fond embrace of Madame la Guillotine. No wonder that on this fine afternoon in September the crowd round Bibot's gate was eager and excited. The lust of blood grows with its satisfaction. There is no satiety. The crowd had seen 100 noble heads fall beneath the guillotine today. It wanted to make sure that it would see another 100 fall on the morrow. Bibot was sitting on an overturned and empty cask close by the gate of the barricade. A small detachment of citoyen soldiers was under his command. The work had been very hot lately. Those cursed aristos were becoming terrified and tried their hardest to slip out of Paris. Men, women, and children, whose ancestors, even in remote ages, had served those traitorous Bourbons, were all traitors themselves and right food for the guillotine. Every day Bibot had had the satisfaction of unmasking some fugitive royalists and sending them back to be tried by the Committee of Public Safety, presided over by that good patriot, citoyen Fouquier-Tinville. Robespierre and Danton both had commended Bibot for his zeal, and Bibot was proud of the fact that he, on his own initiative, had sent at least 50 aristos to the guillotine. But today, all the sergeants in command of the various barricades had had special orders. Recently, a very great number of aristos had succeeded in escaping out of France and in reaching England safely. There were curious rumours about these escapes. They had become very frequent and singularly daring. The people's minds were becoming strangely excited about it all. Sergeant Grospierre had been sent to the guillotine for allowing a whole family of aristos to slip out of the north gate under his very nose. It was asserted that these escapes were organised by a band of Englishmen, whose daring seemed to be unparalleled, and who, from sheer desire to meddle in what did not concern them, spent their spare time in snatching away lawful victims destined for Madame la Guillotine. These rumours soon grew in extravagance. There was no doubt that this band of meddlesome Englishmen did exist. Moreover, they seemed to be under the leadership of a man whose pluck and audacity were almost fabulous. Strange stories were afloat of how he and those aristos whom he rescued became suddenly invisible as they reached the barricades, and escaped out of the gates by sheer supernatural agency. No one had seen these mysterious Englishmen. As for their leader, he was never spoken of, save with a superstitious shudder. Citoyen Fouquier-Tinville would, in the course of the day, receive a scrap of paper from some mysterious source. Sometimes he would find it in the pocket of his coat. At others, it would be handed to him by someone in the crowd, whilst he was on his way to the sitting of the Committee of Public Safety. The paper always contained a brief notice that the band of meddlesome Englishmen were at work, and it was always signed with a device drawn in red, a little star-shaped flower which we in England call the Scarlet Pimpernel. Within a few hours of the receipt of this impudent notice, the citoyen of the Committee of Public Safety would hear that so many royalists and aristocrats had succeeded in reaching the coast and were on their way to England and safety. The guards at the gates had been doubled. The sergeants in command had been threatened with death, whilst liberal rewards were offered for the capture of these daring and impudent Englishmen. There was a sum of 5,000 francs promised to the man who laid hands on the mysterious and elusive Scarlet Pimpernel. Everyone felt that Bibot would be that man, and Bibot allowed that belief to take firm root in everybody's mind. And so, day after day, people came to watch him at the West Gate, so as to be present when he laid hands on any fugitive aristo who perhaps might be accompanied by that mysterious Englishman.
"Bah," he said to his trusted corporal, "Citoyen Grospierre was a fool. Had it been me now at that north gate last week—"
Citoyen Bibot spat on the ground to express his contempt for his comrade's stupidity.
"How did it happen, citoyen?" asked the corporal.
"Grospierre was at the gate keeping good watch," began Bibot pompously, as the crowd closed in round him, listening eagerly to his narrative. We've all heard of this meddlesome Englishman, this accursed Scarlet Pimpernel. He won't get through my gate, morbleu, unless he be the devil himself. But Grospierre was a fool. The market carts were going through the gates. There was one laden with casks, and driven by an old man with a boy beside him. Grospierre was a bit drunk, but he thought himself very clever. He looked into the casks, most of them at least, and saw they were empty, and let the cart go through.
A murmur of wrath and contempt went round the group of ill-clad wretches who crowded round Citoyen Bibot.
"Half an hour later," continued the sergeant, "up comes the captain of the guard with a squad of some dozen soldiers with him. "Has a cart gone through?" he asks of Grospierre breathlessly. "Yes," says Grospierre, "not half an hour ago." "And you have let them escape?" shouts the captain furiously. "You'll go to the guillotine for this, Citoyen Sergeant. That cart helped conceal the ci-devant Duc de Chalys and all his family."
"What?"
thunders Grospierre, aghast. "Aye, and the driver was none other than that cursed Englishman, the Scarlet Pimpernel."
A howl of execration greeted this tale. Citoyen Grospierre had paid for his blunder on the guillotine, but what a fool! Oh, what a fool! Bibot was laughing so much at his own tale that it was some time before he could continue.
"After them, my men," shouts the captain, he said after a while. "Remember the reward. After them. They cannot have gone far." And with that he rushes through the gate, followed by his dozen soldiers.
"But it was too late," shouted the crowd excitedly. "They never got them. Curse that Grospierre for his folly. He deserved his fate. Fancy not examining those casks properly." But these sallies seemed to amuse Citoyen Bibot exceedingly. He laughed until his sides ached, and the tears streamed down his cheeks.
"Nay, nay," he said at last. "Those aristos weren't in the cart. The driver was not the Scarlet Pimpernel."
"What?"
"No. The captain of the guard was that cursed Englishman in disguise, and every one of his soldiers aristos."
The crowd this time said nothing. The story certainly savoured of the supernatural, and though the Republic had abolished God, it had not quite succeeded in killing the fear of the supernatural in the hearts of the people. Truly, that Englishman must be the devil himself. The sun was sinking low down in the west. Bibot prepared himself to close the gates.
"En avant the carts," he said.
Some dozen covered carts were drawn up in a row, ready to leave town, in order to fetch the produce from the country close by, for market the next morning. They were mostly well known to Bibot, as they went through his gate twice every day on their way to and from the town. He spoke to one or two of their drivers, mostly women, and was at great pains to examine the inside of the carts.
"You never know," he would say, "and I'm not going to be caught like that fool Grospierre."
The women who drove the carts usually spent their day on the Place de la Grève, beneath the platform of the guillotine, knitting and gossiping, whilst they watched the rows of tumbrils arriving with the victims the Reign of Terror claimed every day. It was great fun to see the aristos arriving for the reception of Madame la Guillotine, and the places close by the platform were very much sought after. Bibot, during the day, had been on duty on the Place. He recognised most of the old hags, tricoteurs, as they were called, who sat there and knitted whilst head after head fell beneath the knife, and they themselves got quite bespattered with the blood of those cursed aristos.
"Eh, la mère," said Bibot to one of these horrible hags, "what have you got there?"
He had seen her earlier in the day, with her knitting and the whip of her cart close beside her. Now she had fastened a row of curly locks to the whip-handle, all colours, from gold to silver, fair to dark, and she stroked them with her huge bony fingers as she laughed at Bibot.
"I made friends with Madame Guillotine's lover," she said with a coarse laugh. "He cut these off for me from the heads as they rolled down. He has promised me some more tomorrow, but I don't know if I shall be at my usual place."
"Ah, how is that, la mère?"
asked Bibot, who, hardened soldier though he was, could not help shuddering at the awful loathsomeness of this semblance of a woman, with her ghastly trophy on the handle of her whip.
"My grandson has got the smallpox," she said with a jerk of her thumb towards the inside of her cart.
Some say it's the plague. If it is, I shan't be allowed to come into Paris tomorrow.
At the first mention of the word smallpox, Bibo had stepped hastily backwards, and when the old hag spoke of the plague, he retreated from her as fast as he could.
"Curse you," he muttered, whilst the whole crowd hastily avoided the cart, leaving it standing all alone in the midst of the place.
The old hag laughed.
"Curse you, citoyen, for being a coward," she said. "Bah, what a man to be afraid of sickness." "Morbleu, the plague."
Everyone was awestruck and silent, filled with horror for the loathsome malady, the one thing which still had the power to arouse terror and disgust in these savage, brutalized creatures.
"Get out with you and your plague-stricken brood," shouted Bibo hoarsely.
And with another rough laugh and coarse jest, the old hag whipped up her lean nag and drove her cart out of the gate. This incident had spoilt the afternoon. The people were terrified of these two horrible curses, the two maladies which nothing could cure, and which were the precursors of an awful and lonely death. They hung about the barricades, silent and sullen for a while, eyeing one another suspiciously, avoiding each other as if by instinct, lest the plague lurked already in their midst. Presently, as in the case of Grospierre, a captain of the guard appeared suddenly. But he was known to Bibo, and there was no fear of his turning out to be a sly Englishman in disguise.
"A cart!"
he shouted breathlessly, even before he had reached the gates.
"What cart?"
asked Bibo roughly.
"Driven by an old hag, a covered cart." "Well, there were a dozen." "An old hag who said her son had the plague?"
"Yes."
"You have not let them go?"
"Morbleu,"
said Bibo, whose purple cheeks had suddenly become white with fear.
"The cart contained the ci-devant Comtesse de Tournay and her two children, all of them traitors and condemned to death."
"And their driver?"
muttered Bibo, as a superstitious shudder ran down his spine.
"Sacré tonnerre," said the captain. "But it is feared that it was that accursed Englishman himself, the Scarlet Pimpernel."
Chapter 2. Dover. The Fisherman's Rest. In the kitchen, Sally was extremely busy. Saucepans and frying pans were standing in rows on the gigantic hearth. The huge stockpot stood in a corner, and the jack turned with slow deliberation and presented alternately to the glow every side of a noble sirloin of beef. The two little kitchen maids bustled around, eager to help, hot and panting, with cotton sleeves well tucked up above the dimpled elbows, and giggling over some private jokes of their own whenever Miss Sally's back was turned for a moment. And old Jemima, stolid in temper and solid in bulk, kept up a long and subdued grumble while she stirred the stock-pot methodically over the fire.
"What ho, Sally!"
came in cheerful, if none too melodious, accents from the coffee-room close by.
"Now, bless my soul!" exclaimed Sally with a good-humoured laugh. "What be they all wanting now, I wonder?"
"Beer, of course," grumbled Jemima. "You don't expect Jimmy Pitkin to have done with one tankard, do you?"
"Mr. Harry, he looked uncommon thirsty, too,"
simpered Martha, one of the little kitchen-maids, and her beady black eyes twinkled as they met those of her companion, whereupon both started on a round of short and suppressed giggles. Sally looked across for a moment, and thoughtfully rubbed her hands against her shapely hips. Her palms were itching, evidently to come in contact with Martha's rosy cheeks. But inherent good humour prevailed, and with a pout and a shrug of the shoulders, she turned her attention to the fried potatoes.
"What ho, Sally! Hey, Sally!"
And a chorus of pewter mugs tapped with impatient hands against the oak tables of the coffee-room accompanied the shouts for mine host's buxom daughter.
"Sally!" shouted a more persistent voice. "Are you going to be all night with that there beer?"
"I do think Father might get the beer for them,"
muttered Sally, as Jemima stolidly and without further comment took a couple of foam-crowned jugs from the shelf and began filling a number of pewter tankards with some of that home-brewed ale for which the Fisherman's Rest had been famous since the days of King Charles.
"He knows how busy we are in here."
"Your father is too busy discussing politics with Mr. Hempseed to worry himself about you in the kitchen," grumbled Jemima under her breath.
Sally had gone to the small mirror which hung in a corner of the kitchen, and was hastily smoothing her hair and setting her frilled cap at its most becoming angle over her dark curls. Then she took up the tankards by their handles, three in each strong brown hand, and laughing, grumbling, blushing, carried them through into the coffee-room. There was certainly no sign of that bustle and activity which kept four women busy and hot in the glowing kitchen beyond. The coffee-room of the Fisherman's Rest is a show-place now at the beginning of the 20th century. At the end of the 18th, in the year of grace 1792, it had not yet gained that notoriety and importance which 100 additional years and the craze of the age have since bestowed upon it. Yet it was an old place even then, for the oak rafters and beams were already black with age, as were the panelled seats with their tall backs, and the long polished tables between, on which innumerable pewter tankards had left fantastic patterns of many-sized rings. In the leaded window high up, a row of pots of scarlet geraniums and blue larkspur gave the bright note of colour against the dull background of the oak. That Mr. Jellyband, landlord of the Fisherman's Rest at Dover, was a prosperous man, was, of course, clear to the most casual observer. The pewter on the fine old dressers, the brass above the gigantic hearth, shone like gold and silver. The red-tiled floor was as brilliant as the scarlet geranium on the windowsill. This meant that his servants were good and plentiful, that the custom was constant, and of that order which necessitated the keeping up of the coffee-room to a high standard of elegance and order. As Sally came in, laughing through her frowns, and displaying a row of dazzling white teeth, she was greeted with shouts and a chorus of applause.
"Why, here's Sally. Hello, Sally. Hurrah for pretty Sally."
"I saw you grown deaf in that kitchen of yours," muttered Jimmy Pitkin as he passed the back of his hand across his very dry lips.
"All right, all right,"
laughed Sally as she deposited the freshly filled tankards upon the tables.
"My, what a hurry, to be sure. And is your grandmother a-dying and you wanting to see the poor soul afore she'm gone? I never seed such a mighty rushin'."
A chorus of good-humoured laughter greeted this witticism, which gave the company their present food for many jokes for some considerable time. Sally now seemed in less of a hurry to get back to her pots and pans. A young man with fair curly hair and eager bright blue eyes was engaging most of her attention and the whole of her time, whilst broad witticisms anent Jimmy Pitkin's fictitious grandmother flew from mouth to mouth, mixed with heavy puffs of pungent tobacco smoke. Facing the hearth, his legs wide apart, a long clay pipe in his mouth, stood mine host himself, worthy Mr. Jellyband, landlord of the Fisherman's Rest, as his father had been before him, aye, and his grandfather and great-grandfather too, for that matter. Portly in build, jovial in countenance, and somewhat bald of pate, Mr. Jellyband was indeed a typical rural John Bull of those days, the days when our prejudiced insularity was at its height, when to an Englishman, be he lord, yeoman, or peasant, the whole of the continent of Europe was a den of immorality, and the rest of the world an unexploited land of savages and cannibals. There he stood, mine worthy host, firm and well set up on his limbs, smoking his long churchwarden and caring nothing for nobody at home and despising everybody abroad. He wore the typical scarlet waistcoat with shiny brass buttons, the corduroy breeches, the grey worsted stockings and smart buckled shoes that characterised every self-respecting innkeeper in Great Britain in these days. And while pretty motherless Sally had need of four pairs of brown hands to do all the work that fell on her shapely shoulders, worthy Jellyband discussed the affairs of nations with his most privileged guests. The coffee-room, indeed, lighted by two well-polished lamps which hung from the raftered ceiling, looked cheerful and cosy in the extreme. Through the dense clouds of tobacco smoke that hung about in every corner, the faces of Mr. Jellyband's customers appeared red and pleasant to look at, and on good terms with themselves, their host, and all the world. From every side of the room loud guffaws accompanied pleasant, if not highly intellectual, conversation, while Sally's repeated giggles testified to the good use Mr. Harry Waite was making of the short time she seemed inclined to spare him. They were mostly fisher folk who patronised Mr. Jellyband's coffee-room,
but fishermen are known to be very thirsty people. The salt which they breathe in when they are on the sea accounts for their parched throats when on shore. But the Fisherman's Rest was something more than a rendezvous for these humble folk. The London and Dover coach started from the hostel daily, and passengers who had come across the Channel and those who started for the grand tour all became acquainted with Mr. Jellyband, his French wines, and his home-brewed ales. It was towards the close of September 1792, and the weather, which had been brilliant and hot throughout the month, had suddenly broken up. For 2 days torrents of rain had deluged the south of England, doing its level best to ruin what chances the apples and pears and late plums had of becoming really fine, self-respecting fruit. Even now it was beating against the leaded windows and tumbling down the chimney, making the cheerful wood fire sizzle in the hearth.
"Lud,
did you ever see such a wet September, Mr. Jellyband?" asked Mr. Hempseed.
He sat in one of the seats inside the hearth, did Mr. Hempseed, for he was an authority, and an important personage not only at the Fisherman's Rest, where Mr. Jellyband always made a special selection of him as a foil for political arguments, but throughout the neighbourhood, where his learning, and notably his knowledge of the Scriptures, was held in the most profound awe and respect. With one hand buried in the capacious pockets of his corduroys underneath his elaborately worked, well-worn smock, the other holding his long clay pipe, Mr. Hempseed sat there looking dejectedly across the room at the rivulets of moisture which trickled down the window panes.
"No," replied Mr. Jellyband sententiously. "I don't know Mr. Hempseed as I ever did, and I've been in these parts nigh on 60 years. "Aye, you wouldn't recollect the first 3 years of them 60, Mr. Jellyband," quietly interposed Mr. Hempseed. "I dunno as I ever seed an infant take much note of the weather, leastways not in these parts, and I've lived here nigh on 75 years, Mr. Jellyband."
The superiority of this wisdom was so incontestable that for the moment Mr. Jellyband was not ready with his usual flow of argument.
"It do seem more like April than September, don't it?"
continued Mr. Hempseed dolefully, as a shower of raindrops fell with a sizzle upon the fire.
"Aye, that it do," assented the worthy host. "But then what can you expect, Mr. Hempseed, I says, with such a government as we've got?"
Mr. Hempseed shook his head with an infinity of wisdom, tempered by deeply rooted mistrust of the British climate and the British government.
"I don't expect nothing, Mr. Jellyband," he said. "Poor folks like us is of no account up there in London, I knows that. And it's not often as I do complain. But when it comes to such wet weather in September, and all me fruit a-rotting and a-dying like the Gupshan mother's firstborn, and doing no more good than they did, poor dears, save to a lot of Jews, peddlers and such, with their oranges and such like foreign ungodly fruit, which nobody'd buy if English apples and pears was nicely swelled, as the Scriptures say."
"That's quite right, Mr. Hempseed," retorted Jellyband. "And as I says, what can you expect? There's all them Frenchy devils over the Channel yonder a-murdering their king and nobility, and Mr. Pitt and Mr. Fox and Mr. Burke a-fighting and a-wrangling between them. If we Englishmen should allow 'em to go on in their ungodly way, let 'em murder, says Mr. Pitt. Stop 'em, says Mr. Burke."
"And let 'em murder, says I, and be demmed to 'em," said Mr. Hempseed emphatically, for he had but little liking for his friend Jellyband's political arguments, wherein he always got out of his depth, and had but little chance for displaying those pearls of wisdom which had earned for him so high a reputation in the neighbourhood, and so many free tankards of ale at the Fisherman's Rest.
"Let 'em murder," he repeated again, "but don't let's have such rain in September, for that is again the law, and the Scriptures, which says—"
"Lud, Mr. Harry, how you made me jump!"
It was unfortunate for Sally and her flirtation that this remark of hers should have occurred at the precise moment when Mr. Hempseed was collecting his breath, in order to deliver himself of one of those scriptural utterances which had made him famous, for it brought down upon her pretty head the full flood of her father's wrath.
"Now then, Sally, me girl, now then,"
he said, trying to force a frown upon his good-humoured face.
"Stop that fooling with them young jackanapes and get on with the work."
"The work's getting on all right, father."
But Mr. Jellyband was peremptory.
He had other views for his buxom daughter, his only child, who would in God's good time become the owner of the Fisherman's Rest, than to see her married to one of these young fellows who earned but a precarious livelihood with their net.
"Did you hear me speak, my girl?" he said in that quiet tone which no one inside the inn dared to disobey. "Get on with my Lord Tony's supper, for if it ain't the best we can do and he's not satisfied, see what you'll get, that's all."
Reluctantly, Sally obeyed.
"Is you expecting special guests, then, tonight, Mr. Jellyband?"
asked Jimmy Pitkin, in a loyal attempt to divert his host's attention from the circumstances connected with Sally's exit from the room.
"Aye, that I be," replied Jellyband. "Friends of my Lord Tony hisself, dukes and duchesses from over the water yonder, whom the young lord and his friend Sir Andrew Ffoulkes and other young noblemen have helped out of the clutches of them murdering devils."
But this was too much for Mr. Hempseed's querulous philosophy.
"Blood," he said. "What they do that for, I wonder? I don't hold not with interfering in other folks' ways. As the scriptures say—" "Maybe, Mr. Hempseed," interrupted Jellyband with biting sarcasm, "as you're a personal friend of Mr. Pitt, and as you says along with Mr. Ffoulkes, let 'em murder, says you."
"Pardon me, Mr. Jellyband," feebly protested Mr. Hempseed. "I dunno as I ever did—"
But Mr. Jellyband had at last succeeded in getting upon his favourite hobby horse, and had no intention of dismounting in any hurry.
"Or maybe you've made friends with some of them French chaps who they say have come over here a purpose to make us Englishmen agree with their murdering ways."
"I dunno what you mean, Mr. Jellyband," suggested Mr. Hempseed. All I know is,
loudly asserted mine host, "that there was my friend Peppercorn, who owns the Blue-Faced Boar, and as true and loyal an Englishman as you'd see in the land. And now look at him. He made friends with some of them frog-eaters, hobnobbed with them just as if they was Englishmen, and not just a lot of immoral, God-forsaken foreign spies. Well, and what happened? Peppercorn, he now ups and talks of revolutions and liberty and down with the aristocrats, just like Mr. Hempseed over here."
"Oh, pardon me, Mr. Jellyband," again interposed Mr. Hempseed feebly. "I dunno as I ever did—"
Mr. Jellyband had appealed to the company in general, who were listening awestruck and open-mouthed at the recital of Mr. Peppercorn's defalcations. At one table two customers, gentlemen apparently by their clothes, had pushed aside their half-finished game of dominoes, and had been listening for some time, and evidently with much amusement, at Mr. Jellyband's international opinions. One of them now, with a quiet, sarcastic smile still lurking round the corners of his mobile mouth, turned towards the centre of the room where Mr. Jellyband was standing.
"You seem to think, mine honest friend," he said quietly, "that these Frenchmen—spies, I think you called them—are mighty clever fellows to have made mincemeat, so to speak, of your friend Mr. Peppercorn's opinions. How did they accomplish that now, think you?"
"Well, lud, sir, I suppose they talked him over. Those Frenchies, I've heard it said, have got the gift of the gab, and Mr. M.C., dear, will tell you how it is that they just twist some people round their little finger-like."
"Indeed. And is that so, Mr. Hempseed?" inquired the stranger politely.
"Nay, sir," replied Mr. Hempseed, much irritated. "I dunno as I can give you the information you require."
"Faith, then," said the stranger, "let us hope, my worthy host, that these clever spies will not succeed in upsetting your extremely loyal opinions."
But this was too much for Mr. Jellyband's pleasant equanimity. He burst into an uproarious fit of laughter, which was soon echoed by those who happened to be in his debt. He laughed in every key, did my worthy host, and laughed until his sides ached and his eyes streamed.
"At me? Hark at that! Did you say that they'd be upset in my opinions, eh? Oh, Lord love you, sir, but you do say some queer things."
"Well, Mr. Jellyband," said Mr. Hempseed sententiously, "you know what the scriptures say. Let him who stands take heed lest he fall." "But then, harkee, Mr. Hempseed," retorted Jellyband, still holding his sides with laughter, "the scriptures didn't know me. Why, I wouldn't so much as drink a glass of ale with one of them murdering Frenchmen, and nothing would make me change my opinions. Why, I've heard it said that them frog-eaters can't even speak the King's English. So, of course, if any of them tried to speak their God-forsaken lingo to me, why, I should spot them directly, see? And forewarned is forearmed, as the saying goes."
"Aye, my honest friend,
assented the stranger cheerfully. "I see that you are much too sharp and a match for any 20 Frenchmen, and here's to your very good health, my worthy host, and if you'll do me the honour to finish this bottle of mine with me."
"I'm sure you're very polite, sir,"
said Mr. Jellyband, wiping his eyes, which were still streaming with the abundance of his laughter,
"and I don't mind if I do."
The stranger poured out a couple of tankards full of wine, and having offered one to mine host, he took the other himself. "Loyal Englishmen as we all are," he said, whilst the same humorous smile played around the corners of his thin lips, "loyal as we are, we must admit that this at least is one good thing which comes to us from France."
"I will none of us deny that, sir," assented mine host.
"And here's to the best landlord in England, our worthy host, Mr. Jellyband," said the stranger in a loud tone of voice.
"Hip hip hurrah!"
retorted the whole company present. Then there was loud clapping of hands, and mugs and tankards made a rattling music upon the tables, to the accompaniment of loud laughter at nothing in particular, and of Mr. Jellyband's muttered exclamations.
"Just fancy me being talked over by any godforsaken foreigner. What? Lord love you, sir, but you do say some queer things."
To which obvious fact the stranger heartily assented. It was certainly a preposterous suggestion that anyone could ever upset Mr. Jellyband's firmly rooted opinions anent the utter worthlessness of the inhabitants of the whole continent of Europe. Chapter 3. The Refugees. Feeling in every part of England certainly ran very high at this time against the French and their doings. Smugglers and legitimate traders between the French and English coasts brought snatches of news from over the water which made every honest Englishman's blood boil, and made him long to have a good go at those murderers who had imprisoned their king and all his family, subjected the queen and the royal children to every species of indignity, and were even now loudly demanding the blood of the whole Bourbon family and of every one of its adherents. The execution of the Princesse de Lamballe, Marie Antoinette's young and charming friend, had filled everyone in England with unspeakable horror. The daily execution of scores of royalists of good family, whose only sin was their aristocratic name, seemed to cry for vengeance to the whole of civilized Europe. Yet, with all that, no one dared to interfere. Burke had exhausted all his eloquence in trying to induce the British government to fight the revolutionary government of France, but Mr. Pitt, with characteristic prudence, did not feel that this country was fit yet to embark on another arduous and costly war. It was for Austria to take the initiative. Austria, whose fairest daughter was even now a dethroned queen, imprisoned and insulted by a howling mob. And surely 'twas not, so argued Mr. Fox, for the whole of England to take up arms because one set of Frenchmen chose to murder another. As for Mr. Jellyband and his fellow John Bulls, though they looked upon all foreigners with withering contempt, they were royalist and anti-revolutionists to a man, and at this present moment were furious with Pitt for his caution and moderation, although they naturally understood nothing of the diplomatic reasons which guided that great man's policy. But now Sally came running back very excited and very eager. The joyous company in the coffee-room had heard nothing of the noise outside, but she had spied a dripping horse and rider who had stopped at the door of the Fisherman's Rest, and while the stable-boy ran forward to take charge of the horse, pretty Miss Sally went to the front door to greet the welcome visitor.
"I think I see Lord Antony's horse out in the yard, father," she said, as she ran across the coffee-room.
But already the door had been thrown open from outside, and the next moment an arm, covered in drab cloth and dripping with the heavy rain, was round pretty Sally's waist, while a hearty voice echoed along the polished rafters of the coffee-room.
"Aye, and bless your brown eyes for being so sharp, my pretty Sally," said the man who had just entered,
whilst worthy Mr. Jellyband came bustling forward, eager, alert, and fussy, as became the advent of one of the most favoured guests of his hostel.
"Lud, I protest, Sally," added Lord Antony, as he deposited a kiss on Miss Sally's blooming cheeks, "but you are growing prettier and prettier every time I see you. And my honest friend Jellyband here must have hard work to keep the fellows off that slim waist of yours. What say you, Mr. Waite?"
Mr. Waite, torn between his respect for my lord and his dislike of that particular type of joke, only replied with a doubtful grunt. Lord Antony Dewhurst, one of the sons of the Duke of Exeter, was in those days a very perfect type of a young English gentleman. Tall, well set up, broad of shoulders and merry of face. His laughter rang loudly wherever he went. A good sportsman, a lively companion, a courteous, well-bred man of the world, with not too much brains to spoil his temper, he was a universal favourite in London drawing-rooms or in the coffee-rooms of village inns. At the Fisherman's Rest everyone knew him, for he was fond of a trip across to France, and always spent a night under worthy Mr. Jellyband's roof on his way there or back. He nodded to Waite, Pitkin, and the others, as he at last released Sally's waist and crossed over to the hearth to warm and dry himself. As he did so, he cast a quick, somewhat suspicious glance at the two strangers, who had quietly resumed their game of dominoes, and for a moment a look of deep earnestness, even of anxiety, clouded his jovial face. But only for a moment. The next he had turned to Mr. Hempseed, who was respectfully touching his forelock. "Well, Mr. Hempseed, and how is the fruit?"
"Badly, my lord, badly," replied Mr. Hempseed dolefully. "But what can you expect with this here government favouring them rascals over in France, who would murder their king and all their nobility?"
"Odd's life," retorted Lord Antony. "So they would, honest Hempseed. At least those they can get hold of, worse luck. But we've got some friends coming here tonight who at any rate have evaded their clutches."
It almost seemed, when the young man said these words, as if he threw a defiant look towards the quiet strangers in the corner.
"Thanks to you, my lord, and to your friends, so I've heard it said," said Mr. Jellyband.
But in a moment Lord Antony's hand fell warningly on mine host's arm.
"Hush,"
he said peremptorily, and instinctively once again looked towards the strangers.
"Oh, Lud love you, they are all right, my lord," retorted Jellyband. "Don't you be afraid. I wouldn't have spoken, only I knew we were among friends. That gentleman over there is as true and loyal a subject of King George as you are yourself, my lord, saving your presence. He is but lately arrived in Dover, and is settling down in business in these parts."
"In business? Faith, then, it must be as an undertaker, for I vow I never beheld a more rueful countenance.
Nay, my lord, I believe that the gentleman is a widower, which no doubt would account for the melancholy of his bearing. But he is a friend, nevertheless, I'll vouch for that. And you will own, my lord, that who should judge of a face better than the landlord of a popular inn?"
"Well, that's all right, then, if we are among friends," said Lord Antony, who evidently did not care to discuss the subject with his host. "But tell me, you have no one else staying here, have you?"
"Well, no one, my lord, and no one coming either, leastways—"
"Leastways—"
"Well, no one your lordship would object to, I know."
"Who is it?"
"Well, my lord, Sir Percy Blakeney and his lady will be here presently, but they ain't a-going to stay."
"Lady Blakeney?" queried Lord Antony in some astonishment.
"Aye, my lord. Sir Percy's skipper was here just now. He says that my lady's brother is crossing over to France today in the Daydream, which is Sir Percy's yacht, and Sir Percy and my lady will come with him as far as here to see the last of him. It don't put you out, do it, my lord?"
"Oh, no, no, it doesn't put me out, friend. Nothing will put me out, unless that supper is not the very best which Miss Sally can cook, and which has ever been served in the Fisherman's Rest."
"You need have no fear of that, my lord," said Sally, who all this while had been busy setting the table for supper, and very gay and inviting it looked, with a large bunch of brilliantly coloured dahlias in the centre, and the bright pewter goblets and blue china about.
"How many shall I lay for, my lord?"
5 places, pretty Sally, but let the supper be enough for 10 at least. Our friends will be tired and, I hope, hungry. As for me, I vow I could demolish a baron of beef tonight."
"Here they are, I do believe," said Sally excitedly, as a distant clatter of horses and wheels could now be distinctly heard, drawing rapidly nearer.
There was general commotion in the coffee-room. Everyone was curious to see my Lord Antony's swell friends from over the water. Miss Sally cast one or two quick glances at the little bit of mirror which hung on the wall, and worthy Mr. Jellyband bustled out in order to give the first welcome himself to his distinguished guests. Only the two strangers in the corner did not participate in the general excitement. They were calmly finishing their game of dominoes, and did not even look once towards the door.
"Straight ahead, Comtesse, the door on your right," said a pleasant voice outside.
"Aye, there they are, all right enough," said Lord Antony joyfully. "Off with you, my pretty Sally, and see how quickly you can dish up the soup."
The door was thrown wide open, and, preceded by Mr. Jellyband, who was profuse in his bows and welcomes, a party of 4, Two ladies and two gentlemen entered the coffee-room.
"Welcome! Welcome to Old England," said Lord Antony effusively, as he came eagerly forward with both hands outstretched towards the newcomers.
"Ah, you are Lord Antony Dewhurst, I think," said one of the ladies, speaking with a strong foreign accent.
"At your service, madame," he replied, as he ceremoniously kissed the hands of both the ladies, then turned to the men and shook them both warmly by the hand.
Sally was already helping the ladies to take off their travelling cloaks, and both turned with a shiver towards the brightly blazing hearth. There was a general movement among the company in the coffee-room. Sally had bustled off to her kitchen, whilst Jellyband, still profuse with his respectful salutations, arranged one or two chairs around the fire. Mr. Hempseed, touching his forelock, was quietly vacating the seat in the hearth. Everyone was staring curiously, yet deferentially, at the foreigners.
"Ah, monsieur, what can I say?"
said the elder of the two ladies, as she stretched a pair of fine, aristocratic hands to the warmth of the blaze, and looked with unspeakable gratitude first at Lord Antony, and then at one of the young men who had accompanied her party, and who was busy divesting himself of his heavy, caped coat.
"Only that you are glad to be in England, Comtesse," replied Lord Antony, "and that you have not suffered too much from your trying voyage."
Indeed, we are glad to be in England,"
she said, while her eyes filled with tears,
"and we have already forgotten all that we have suffered."
Her voice was musical and low, and there was a great deal of calm dignity and of many sufferings nobly endured marked in the handsome, aristocratic face, with its wealth of snow-white hair dressed high above the forehead after the fashion of the times.
"I hope my friend Sir Andrew Ffoulkes proved an entertaining travelling companion, madame."
"Indeed, Sir Andrew was kindness itself. How could my children and I ever show enough gratitude to you all, monsieur?"
Her companion, a dainty, girlish figure, childlike and pathetic in its look of fatigue and of sorrow, had said nothing as yet, but her eyes, large, brown, and full of tears, looked up from the fire and sought those of Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, who had drawn near to the hearth and to her. Then, as they met his, which were fixed with unconcealed admiration upon the sweet face before him, a thought of warmer colour rushed up to her pale cheeks.
"So this is England,"
she said, as she looked round with childlike curiosity at the great open hearth, the oak rafters, and the yokels with their elaborate smocks and jovial rubicund British countenances.
"A bit of it, mademoiselle," replied Sir Andrew, smiling, "but all of it at your service."
The young girl blushed again, but this time a bright smile, fleet and sweet, illumined her dainty face. She said nothing, and Sir Andrew, too, was silent. Yet those two young people understood one another, as young people have a way of doing all the world over, and have done since the world began.
"But I say, supper!" here broke in Lord Antony's jovial voice. "Supper, honest Jellyband! Where is that pretty wench of yours, and the dish of soup? Zooks, man, while you stand there gaping at the ladies, they will faint with hunger."
One moment, my lord,"
said Jellyband, as he threw open the door that led to the kitchen, and shouted lustily,
"Sally! Hey, Sally, there! Are you ready, my girl?"
Sally was ready, and the next moment she appeared in the doorway carrying a gigantic tureen, from which rose a cloud of steam and an abundance of savoury odour.
"Odds my life, supper at last!" ejaculated Lord Antony merrily, as he gallantly offered his arm to the Comtesse. "May I have the honour?"
he added ceremoniously, as he led her towards the supper-table. There was general bustle in the coffee-room. Mr. Hempseed and most of the yokels and fisherfolk had gone to make way for the quality, and to finish smoking their pipes elsewhere. Only the two strangers stayed on, quietly and unconcernedly playing their game of dominoes and sipping their wine, whilst at another table Harry Waite, who was fast losing his temper, watched pretty Sally bustling round the table. She looked a very dainty picture of English rural life, and no wonder that the susceptible young Frenchman could scarce take his eyes off her pretty face. The Vicomte de Tournay was scarce 19, a beardless boy on whom the terrible tragedies which were being enacted in his own country had made but little impression. He was elegantly and even foppishly dressed, and once safely landed in England, he was evidently ready to forget the horrors of the Revolution in the delights of English life.
"Pardi, if this is England," he said as he continued to ogle Sally with marked satisfaction, "I am of it satisfied."
It would be impossible at this point to record the exact exclamation which escaped through Mr. Harry Waite's clenched teeth.
Only respect for the quality, and notably for my Lord Antony, kept his marked disapproval of the young foreigner in check.
"Nay, but this is England, you abandoned young reprobate," interposed Lord Antony with a laugh. "And do not, I pray, bring your loose foreign ways into this most moral country."
Lord Antony had already sat down at the head of the table with the Comtesse on his right. Jellyband was bustling round, filling glasses and putting chairs straight. Sally waited, ready to hand round the soup. Mr. Harry Waite's friends had at last succeeded in taking him out of the room, for his temper was growing more and more violent under the Vicomte's obvious admiration for Sally.
"Suzanne,"
came in stern, commanding accents from the rigid Comtesse.
Suzanne blushed again. She had lost count of time and of place whilst she had stood beside the fire, allowing the handsome young Englishman's eyes to dwell upon her sweet face, and his hand, as if unconsciously, to rest upon hers. Her mother's voice brought her back to reality once more, and with a submissive,
"Yes, Mama,"
she too took her place at the supper table.
Chapter 4. The League of the Scarlet Pimpernel.
They all looked a merry, even a happy party, as they sat round the table. Sir Andrew Ffoulkes and Lord Antony Dewhurst, two typical good-looking, well-born and well-bred Englishmen of that year of grace 1792, and the aristocratic French Comtesse with her two children, who had just escaped from such dire perils and found a safe retreat at last on the shores of protecting England. In the corner the two strangers had apparently finished their game. One of them arose, and, standing with his back to the merry company at the table, he adjusted with much deliberation his large, triple-caped coat. As he did so, he gave one quick glance all around him. Everyone was busy laughing and chatting, and he murmured the words, "All safe." His companion then, with the alertness born of long practice, slipped onto his knees in a moment, and the next had crept noiselessly under the oak bench. The stranger then, with a loud, "Good night," quietly walked out of the coffee-room. Not one of those at the supper-table had noticed this curious and silent manoeuvre, but when the stranger finally closed the door of the coffee-room behind him, they all instinctively sighed a sigh of relief. "Alone at last," said Lord Antony jovially. Then the young Vicomte de Tournay rose, glass in hand, and with the graceful affectation peculiar to the times, he raised it aloft and said in broken English,
"To His Majesty George III of England, God bless him for his hospitality to us all, poor exiles from France."
"His Majesty the King,"
echoed Lord Antony and Sir Andrew, as they drank loyally to the toast.
"To His Majesty King Louis of France," added Sir Andrew with solemnity, "may God protect him and give him victory over his enemies."
Everyone rose and drank this toast in silence. The fate of the unfortunate King of France, then a prisoner of his own people, seemed to cast a gloom even over Mr. Jellyband's pleasant countenance.
"And to Monsieur le Comte de Tournay de Basserive," said Lord Antony merrily, "may we welcome him in England before many days are over."
"Ah, monsieur," said the Comtesse, as with a slightly trembling hand she conveyed her glass to her lips,
"I scarcely dare to hope."
But already Lord Antony had served out the soup, and for the next few moments all conversation ceased, while Jellyband and Sally handed round the plates, and everyone began to eat.
"Au faith, madame," said Lord Antony after a while, "mine was no idle toast. Seeing yourself, Mademoiselle Suzanne, and my friend the Vicomte safely in England now, surely you must feel reassured as to the fate of Monsieur le Comte."
"Ah, monsieur," replied the Comtesse with a heavy sigh, "I trust in God. I can but pray and hope."
"Aye, madame," here interposed Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, "trust in God by all means, but believe also a little in your English friends, who have sworn to bring the Count safely across the Channel, even as they have brought you today."
"Indeed, indeed, monsieur," she replied, "I have the fullest confidence in you and in your friends,
Your fame, I assure you, has spread throughout the whole of France. The way some of my own friends have escaped from the clutches of that awful revolutionary tribunal was nothing short of a miracle, and all done by you and your friends.
We were but the hands, Madame la Comtesse.
But my husband, monsieur,
said the Comtesse, whilst unshed tears seemed to veil her voice.
He is in such deadly peril. I would never have left him, only there were my children. I was torn between my duty to him and to them. They refused to go without me, and you and your friends assured me so solemnly that my husband would be safe. But oh, now that I am here amongst you all, in this beautiful free England, I think of him flying for his life, hunted like a poor beast, in such peril. Ah, I should not have left him. I should not have left him.
The poor woman had completely broken down. Fatigue, sorrow, and emotion had overmastered her rigid, aristocratic bearing. She was crying gently to herself, whilst Suzanne ran up to her and tried to kiss away her tears. Lord Antony and Sir Andrew had said nothing to interrupt the Comtesse whilst she was speaking. There was no doubt that they felt deeply for her. Their very silence testified to that. But in every century, and ever since England has been what it is, an Englishman has always felt somewhat ashamed of his own emotion and of his own sympathy. And so the two young men said nothing, and busied themselves in trying to hide their feelings, only succeeding in looking immeasurably sheepish.
"As for me, monsieur,"
said Suzanne suddenly, as she looked through a wealth of brown curls across at Sir Andrew,
"I trust you absolutely, and I know that you will bring my dear father safely to England, just as you brought us today."
This was said with so much confidence, such unuttered hope and belief, that it seemed as if by magic to dry the mother's eyes, and to bring a smile upon everybody's lips.
"Nay, you shame me, mademoiselle," replied Sir Andrew. "Though my life is at your service, I have been but a humble tool in the hands of our great leader who organized and effected your escape." He had spoken with so much warmth and vehemence that Suzanne's eyes fastened upon him in undisguised wonder.
"Your leader, monsieur," said the Comtesse eagerly. "Ah, of course you must have a leader, and I did not think of that before. But tell me, where is he? I must go to him at once, and I and my children must throw ourselves at his feet and thank him for all that he has done for us."
"Alas, madame," said Lord Antony, "that is impossible."
"Impossible? Why?"
"Because the Scarlet Pimpernel works in the dark, and his identity is only known under a solemn oath of secrecy to his immediate followers."
"The Scarlet Pimpernel," said Suzanne with a merry laugh. "Why, what a droll name! What is this Scarlet Pimpernel, monsieur?"
She looked at Sir Andrew with eager curiosity. The young man's face had become almost transfigured. His eyes shone with enthusiasm. Hero worship, love, admiration for his leader seemed literally to glow upon his face. "The Scarlet Pimpernel, mademoiselle," he said at last, "is the name of a humble English wayside flower. But it is also the name chosen to hide the identity of the best and bravest man in all the world, so that he may better succeed in accomplishing the noble task he has set himself to do."
"Ah, yes," here interposed the young Vicomte. "I have heard speak of this Scarlet Pimpernel. A little flower, red, yes? They say in Paris that every time a royalist escapes to England, that devil Fouquier Tinville, the public prosecutor, receives a paper with that little flower designated in red upon it. Yes?"
"Yes, that is so," assented Lord Antony.
"Then he will have received one such paper today."
"Undoubtedly."
"Oh, I wonder what he will say," said Suzanne merrily. "I have heard that the picture of that little red flower is the only thing that frightens him."
"Oh, faith, then," said Sir Andrew, "he will have many more opportunities of studying the shape of that small scarlet flower."
"Ah, monsieur," sighed the Comtesse, "it all sounds like a romance, and I cannot understand it all."
"Why should you try, madame?"
"But tell me, why should your leader, why should you all spend your money and risk your lives? For it is your lives you risk, messieurs, when you set foot in France, and all for us Frenchmen and women who are nothing to you."
"Sport, Madame la Comtesse, sport," asserted Lord Antony, with his jovial, loud, and pleasant voice. "We are a nation of sportsmen, you know, and just now it is the fashion to pull the hare from between the teeth of the hound."
"Ah, no, no,
Not sport only, monsieur. You have a more noble motive, I am sure, for the good work you do.
Oh, faith, madame, I would like you to find it, then. As for me, I vow I love the game, for this is the finest sport I have yet encountered. Hairbreadth escapes, the devil's own risks. Tally-ho, and away we go.
But the Comtesse shook her head, still incredulously. To her it seemed preposterous that these young men and their great leader, all of them rich, probably well-born and young, should, for no other motive than sport, run the terrible risks which she knew they were constantly doing. Their nationality, once they had set foot in France, would be no safeguard to them. Anyone found harbouring or assisting suspected royalists would be ruthlessly condemned and summarily executed, whatever his nationality might be. And this band of young Englishmen had, to her own knowledge, bearded the implacable and bloodthirsty tribunal of the Revolution within the very walls of Paris itself, and had snatched away condemned victims almost from the very foot of the guillotine. With a shudder she recalled the events of the last few days, her escape from Paris with her two children, all three of them hidden beneath the hood of a rickety cart and lying amidst a heap of turnips and cabbages, not daring to breathe, whilst the mob howled, "À la lanterne, les aristos!" at that awful west barricade. It had all occurred in such a miraculous way. She and her husband had understood that they had been placed on the list of suspected persons, which meant that their trial and death was but a matter of days, of hours, perhaps. Then came the hope of salvation, the mysterious epistle signed with the enigmatical scarlet device, the clear peremptory directions, the parting from the Comte de Tournay, which had torn the poor wife's heart in two, the hope of reunion, the flight with her two children, the covered cart, that awful hag driving it, who looked like some horrible evil demon with the ghastly trophy on her whip-handle. The Comtesse looked round at the quaint old-fashioned English inn, the peace of this land of civil and religious liberty, and she closed her eyes to shut out the haunting vision of that west barricade, and of the mob retreating panic-stricken when the old hag spoke of the plague. Every moment under that cart she expected recognition, arrest, herself and her children tried and condemned, and these young Englishmen, under the guidance of their brave and mysterious leader, had risked their lives to save them all, as they had already saved scores of other innocent people. And all only for sport? Impossible. Suzanne's eyes, as she sought those of Sir Andrew, plainly told him that she thought that he, at any rate, rescued his fellow men from terrible and unmerited death through a higher and nobler motive than his friend would have her believe.
"How many are there in your brave league, monsieur?"
she asked timidly.
20 all told, mademoiselle," he replied. "One to command and 19 to obey. All of us Englishmen, and all pledged to the same cause, to obey our leader and to rescue the innocent."
"May God protect you all, monsieur," said the Comtesse fervently.
"He has done that so far, madame."
"It is wonderful to me, wonderful, that you should all be so brave, so devoted to your fellow men, yet you are English. And in France, treachery is rife, all in the name of liberty and fraternity."
"The women, even in France, have been more bitter against us aristocrats than the men," said the Vicomte with a sigh.
"Ah, yes," added the Comtesse, whilst a look of haughty disdain and intense bitterness shot through her melancholy eyes.
"There was that woman, Marguerite Saint-Just, for instance. She denounced the Marquis de Saint-Cyr and all his family to the awful tribunal of the Terror."
"Marguerite Saint-Just?" said Lord Antony, as he shot a quick and apprehensive glance across at Sir Andrew. "Marguerite Saint-Just? Surely—"
"Yes," replied the Comtesse.
"Surely you know her. She was a leading actress of the Comédie Française, and she married an Englishman lately. You must know her."
"Oh, know her?" said Lord Antony. "Know Lady Blakeney? The most fashionable woman in London? The wife of the richest man in England? Of course we all know Lady Blakeney."
"She was a schoolfellow of mine at the convent in Paris," interposed Suzanne, "and we came over to England together to learn your language. I was very fond of Marguerite, and I cannot believe that she ever did anything so wicked."
"Well, it certainly seems incredible," said Sir Andrew. "You say that she actually denounced the Marquis de Saint-Cyr? Why should she have done such a thing? Surely there must be some mistake."
"No mistake is possible, monsieur," rejoined the Comtesse coldly.
Marguerite Saint-Just's brother is a noted Republican. There was some talk of a family feud between him and my cousin, the Marquis de Saint-Cyr. The Saint-Justs are quite plebeian, and the Republican government employs many spies. I assure you there is no mistake. You had not heard this story?
Oh, faith, madame, I did hear some vague rumours of it, but in England no one would credit it. Sir Percy Blakeney, her husband, is a very wealthy man of high social position, the intimate friend of the Prince of Wales, and Lady Blakeney leads both fashion and society in London.
That may be, monsieur, and we shall, of course, lead a very quiet life in England. But I pray God that while I remain in this beautiful country, I may never meet Marguerite Saint-Just.
The proverbial wet blanket seemed to have fallen over the merry little company gathered round the table. Suzanne looked sad and silent. Sir Andrew fidgeted uneasily with his fork, whilst the Comtesse, encased in the plate armour of her aristocratic prejudices, sat rigid and unbending in her straight-backed chair. As for Lord Antony, he looked extremely uncomfortable, and glanced once or twice apprehensively towards Jellyband, who looked just as uncomfortable as himself.
"At what time do you expect Sir Percy and Lady Blakeney?" he contrived to whisper unobserved to mine host.
"Any moment, my lord," whispered Jellyband in reply.
Even as he spoke, a distant clatter was heard of an approaching coach. Louder and louder it grew. One or two shouts became distinguishable, then the rattle of horses' hoofs on the uneven cobblestones, and the next moment a stable-boy had thrown open the coffee-room door and rushed in excitedly.
"Sir Percy Blakeney and my lady," he shouted at the top of his voice. "They're just arriving."
And with more shouting, jingling of harness, and iron hoofs upon the stones, a magnificent coach, drawn by four superb bays, had halted outside the porch of the Fisherman's Rest.